City. So thank you all for coming to join us for this evening's presentation. It's my responsibility to ask you if you have a cell phone or a pager or anything electronic that's going to make some noise. If you can take it out and silence it for us for the next hour, that would be wonderful. It's my pleasure to welcome Mr. Bill Dean, one of my very loyal trustees, to introduce our speaker this evening.
Thank you. I just turned off my cell phone. So welcome, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to our guest speaker tonight, Gail Rubenstein. He was born, he was schooled in the Danbury, Connecticut area, was an undergraduate at Princeton, and then a Rhodes Scholar, studying at New College, Oxford for what must have been absolutely three wonderful years. The one gap in my education that I would really so much miss is that I really would have loved to have studied abroad for 1 year, but with the draft board and everyone else after me, that never quite happened. Then he did his PhD in English at Harvard. He specializes very much in Renaissance literature. Then joined the faculty at Harvard and then taught at Princeton, where he also held a series of senior administrative positions. He then went on to the Mellon Foundation in New York and then served as president of Harvard University from 1991 to 2001. Since stepping down from Harvard, he has been involved in a digital arts venture called Art Store and continued to teach at Princeton. And of particular interest, I think, to us is that he is now the chairman of the New York Public Library's Board of Trustees. And whenever I meet an eminence from the New York Public Library, I love to say to them, "We are so much older than you are." We started in 1754. It took you people an additional 141 years to get your act together and start in 1895. And I want to also point out that we are not just a private library, we are also a public library. Our library is open to any member of the public to use. But every time I've said that to either Sam Butler or to Paul Leclerc, they then have crushed me. And they have said, "You may be older, but we are bigger." Our speaker is the author of Ideas of Order, published a close reading of Shakespeare's sonnets, published by Forrest Strauss, and our topic tonight is a very exciting topic of Shakespeare's sonnets. Welcome.
Thank you very much indeed, and thank you for braving the weather. I want to say that I'm very pleased to be here. I want to talk tonight about the main question of whether there is an order, some kind of a construction that makes sense in terms of either dramatic or narrative order to Shakespeare's sonnets, or whether they're this more or less random collection of lyric poems that he wrote over a number of years. We don't know exactly how many years, but we know that it was a good number of years. I'd like to explore whether there is a group of characters and a set of incidents that make sense coherently so that when we read the sonnets, we can actually come away with an idea of whether they make sense as a whole or not. I think it's fair to say that there have been a good many people who have tried to say that on the whole, most critics and scholars have been skeptical as to whether the results have been persuasive or not. And we might well ask why this question is so difficult. First of all, there are 154 of these signs. They're all quite complicated, and they don't reveal in any very obvious way a complete narrative or plot, so to speak. So that's one problem. Second, there's no question, as in all sonic sequences, there's a certain amount of going back and forth here and there, and there are a reasonable number of sonnets that you might well say are, gosh, that one seems to be out of place, and why is that coming here? And I think that's absolutely correct. There are some that want to look completely misplaced. At the same time, there aren't so many of those that they obscure what seem to be the larger patterns in the work as a whole. The other thing is that we have no, unfortunately, external evidence of any kind to let us know whether, in fact, one or another proposition is true. We don't know whether the order in which the sonnets are printed was the order in which Shakespeare himself put them. We don't know whether he had any hand in the actual publication of the sonnets, which was 1609 edition when he was still alive. They might have been pirated, as many things were pirated in the Renaissance period. Or they may have been something that he had thought an awful lot about and wanted to put it in a particular order and make sure that they stayed that way. We don't even know the identity of the person to whom they were dedicated. It's a person named Mr. W.H. And there have been masses of people who have combed all the archives possible in order to find out who Mr. W.H. might be. So far, I would say nobody has been persuasive on the subject. Nevertheless, in spite of all these problems, internal evidence and external evidence, it does seem to me that there are a number of significant and important actions, as well as a set of personages, that do make this much more than a random collection. Who are the characters? Well, there's the poet himself. There's a young man who becomes the patron of the poet. That is, the poet is his favorite poet. It also happens that the poet is in love with the young man. There are several rival poets trying to get the attention of the patron of the poet. And then there's the mistress of the poet, the so-called dark lady, who comes in only briefly in the first part of the sequence, but comes in very strongly later on. Beyond the characters, the incidents, the actual actions of the sonnet seem to me to make sense. They're not at all random in their placement. And they have a progression that amounts to a kind of narrative. There's a very clear beginning. There's a complicated middle. But this is also a very decisive end to the story. In my reading, I was intrigued by an essay by someone called Richard Blackmore, who happened to be one of my teachers at Princeton. You may or may not have heard of him. But he said that, from his point of view, the sonnets revealed something like a desirable development, and didn't use the word ideal, but it came close to that order. And for skeptics, Blackmore suggested that they try reading the sonnets in reverse and see how it sounded or seemed. I've tried the experiment, and as Blackmore said, if you do that, you will find that the poems turn themselves around of their own force. And that's exactly what does in fact happen. There's no way they make sense backwards, as it were. The development is clear in the other direction. Blackmore, who was an extraordinary person with an extraordinary mind, at least clinched the case for me. That doesn't mean it solved the mystery, as it were. by summarizing what seems to be the nature of the relationships amongst the main personages, as well as the crucial events that unfold in the sequence. Along the way, I'll try to point out at least some of the patterns that emerge from the work as a whole, so that we won't have to wait till the end to be told that. Let me start with the people. As I mentioned before, the poet himself is in love with the young man. That's perfectly clear by Sonnet 10, and certainly before 20. And it's also clear that the poet's affection is to a considerable amount reciprocated by the patron young man, so that there's a mutuality at the very beginning. Now, the nature of the love relationship, as you might imagine, has been characterized in very different ways by different scholars. And I myself think, according to one of the poems, that sonnet number 20, that the poet is really seeking a love commitment that you might call a marriage of true minds. The understanding is, and it's said quite explicitly in one of the sonnets, that sexual activity will be reserved in terms of relationships with women, such as the poet's relationship with his mistress. And later on, the patron also becomes involved with the mistress. So the only complication in this mutuality is the fact that the poet's concern and affection for the young man is clearly much stronger than the other way around. The young man is rather self-centered. We get that fairly early on. And it's clear that his commitment to the poet is simply less strong and can be relied upon much less than the other way around. As a result, the sensual affairs, and there are several, of the young man with other people are viewed and felt by the poet to be forms of betrayal or infidelity. These feelings are heightened by the fact that the poet himself is older than the young man, he's less handsome, he's socially inferior, and he says on one occasion that he's almost self-despising, that is, he really doesn't think very much of himself in his gloomiest moments. He frequently fears that he'll be deserted entirely by the youth, by the young man. He also worries whether his poetry is worthy of the patron. And he is, in short, extraordinarily vulnerable, whereas the young man is invincibly self-secure, never seems to doubt himself or anybody else. A word about the mistress or dark lady. She appears early in the sequence as the poet's own mistress, and then she reappears at the end as a major commanding figure in the final poems of the whole work. There we discover that not only the poet, but also the friend, the patron, is entirely under her spell, enslaved by an uncontrollable lust for her, in spite of her utter promiscuousness. So the end has both the patron and the poet under the spell of the mistress, so-called dark lady. If we shift from the main characters and their relationships, we can begin to review some of the major incidents that form the spine of the sequence. The first 17 sonnets have struck most readers as very puzzling. The poet's attempting to persuade the young man to marry and produce a son, not in order to preserve the family's wealth or heritage, nor to follow the religious commandment to increase and multiply, but simply and purely to preserve the youth's image and his extraordinary beauty in the prison of the sun. This allows the poet to praise the young man, ultimately expressing his love, while discovering in the process that his feelings, as I said before, are to some extent reciprocated. Because the poet becomes the friend's favorite writer, kind of slipped there through the first 17 poems. There's a kind of urging to get married and produce a son. Then suddenly, when it becomes clear that there is a relationship there, the poet himself says, I will, through my verse, make you eternal and preserve your image as it is. At this point, I'd like to turn to one sonnet that we all know very well. If there's a genuine development in the work, it ought to be the case that if you take any one of the sonnets, but particularly, let's say, one of the really well-known ones, and put it in its context rather than reading it in an anthology or a school textbook. If you put it in its context, its orderly place in the sequence, it ought to take on a different meaning. It ought to look and sound and feel differently. It ought to be part of some kind of an unfolding drama, so to speak. I want to just try that experiment with you, and I'll read the poem first just to remind us of it. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease has all too short a day. Sometime too hot the eye of heaven shines, and often is his gold complexion dimmed. And every fair from fair sometimes declines, by chance or nature's changing course untrimmed. But thy eternal summer shall not fade, nor lose possession of that fair thou owest. Nor shall death brag thou wanders in his shade, when in eternal lines to time thou growest. So long as men can breathe or eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee. So it's the poet who now is giving life to the image of the young man. Now, when we read this as a single poem on its own, the meaning seems fairly clear. The poet praises the beauty of another person and insists that the other person beauty will not die. It'll always be immortalized in verse. If there's something unusual about the poem, it's the fact that the description of the other person is rather vague. If you look at analogous sonnets early on in sonnet sequences by other writers, you'll find that there's usually something called a blason, that is a description of the person's face, hair, eyes, beauty in some detail. Obviously, we do not get this in Shakespeare's poem, and you may well wonder why. Well, if the opening's somewhat surprising, there are, of course, other more radical surprises to come. We soon realize that the sonnet is not addressed to a woman, I've already suggested that, but in its context, read where it is in the sequence, it's addressed to the young man. Moreover, the sonnet comes immediately after the moment when the poet has been chosen to be the victim, the youth, or the young man's favorite writer. So these lines are not only a celebration of the young man's beauty, they're also a kind of performance intended to please the young man and to show how skillful, as it were, the poet is. Since he's going to be the chosen poet, he has to, in effect, constantly impress the patron. In view of this, we might think a little more carefully about the opening line and question. Is it simply a conventional beginning or an actual question from the poet to the friend? Something like, well, I can do anything you'd like. Would you like a poem about spring or maybe something about a summer's day? I can produce whatever seems good for the mood at the moment. But when performance enters into the situation, there's always obviously some element of manipulation, some element of performance. The poet necessarily assumes a role, and he uses his art to affect his audience, predominantly the young man, but also anyone who happens to be reading the sequence as a whole. Now, once performance performance and manipulation enter the situation, it becomes increasingly difficult to separate poetry that expresses real love and commitment from that of mere flattery. Now, it's never easy to tell either one, although there are cases where one or the other seems fairly obvious. There's a large middle section which is more difficult to analyze. The danger of slipping into flattery is one of the familiar ones in Elizabethan literature, but it reaches much greater depths in Shakespeare than in any other writer in Elizabethan work. In fact, it's one of the central themes of the sonnet sequence, culminating later in the so-called rival poet series, which we'll come to in a minute or two. In addition, Sonnet 18 is unusual both in its tone and its style. The poem is marvelously paced and lucid. It moves wonderfully in a steady way toward the couplet. The poet is not at all doubtful that his verse will conquer all obstacles and will immortalize the young friend. Actually, however, many poems in Shakespeare's sonnets are more powerful, more profound, and far more moving than this one. But that's very much to the point. Shall I compare thee expresses precisely what's appropriate at this very early moment in the sequence. In other words, again, getting back to whether there's an unfolding drama here or not. This particular kind of poem and its depth, or to some extent its lack of depth, is right for this moment because it's an early moment. Time and death are momentarily defeated. Love has not yet been tested or blemished in any way, nor the gold complexion dimmed. It's a moment of early triumph for the poet, when everything seems to be within his control, his reach, and his grasp. Well, I wanted to look at this sonnet for a couple of minutes in detail, because if we analyze it, it throws some light on how we ought to read and approach every sonnet in the sequence. That is, we need to think of the poems as parts of a developing situation or conversation in which the poet's voice is constantly responding to a set of particular circumstances. Most of the sonnets are not, of course, considered to be extraordinary or great in the way that our anthologized favorite ones seem to be. But that's because the large majority of them should be viewed as if they were embedded in a continuing dialogue or conversation or a predicament, rather than as they were general statements intended to stand alone and end with a triumphant couplet. Once we read them as elements of an unfolding drama, we can see why so many of them appear to finish as if they were incomplete or inconclusive. They are so, and they were actually intended to be. Even the famous grand sonnets, as we've just seen, reveal their full meaning only when we analyze them in context, where their preceding sonnets and the following ones illuminate them in ways that we would otherwise not suspect. Now, not long after Sonnet 18, two major events occur in rapid succession. On each of these occasions, the young friend is essentially unfaithful to the poet. In the first, he simply vanishes in the company of other people who appear to take him away, leaving the poet alone, as if the spirit of the mutual love commitment were entirely broken. The poet accuses the friend of having deserted him, and perhaps surprisingly, the young friend quickly returns. He repents, and he also weeps in contrition. In short, there's a clear reconciliation and recommitment on part of the two men. This pattern of an act of infidelity followed at some point by a reunion is intrinsic to the very structure of the sonnets and will be repeated several times in the development of the sequence. The next major incident is a very different one from the first. In Sonnet 40, we discover that the young man has actually taken the poet's mistress away from him and act of betrayal, but also usurpation. The poet has been robbed, yet he's in effect compelled to accept the situation because of the depth of his love. He has no real alternative, but he now protests much more openly than he did on the first occasion when he felt betrayed. He's much more vigorous, and he characterizes the young man as lascivious grace. The phrase sums up the youth's beguiling beauty as well as his apparent unfettered sensual appetite. He appears to be simultaneously unfaithful, but also magnetic. Magnetism wins out, and the poet reaffirms his love, saying, "Kill me with spites, yet we must not be foes." So, in the second incident, there's a stronger response, in other words, to the betrayal than there was in the first, and there's no immediate reconciliation. So we've moved one step along a way that's a very important way in the sequence as a whole. In the set of poems that follow, the poet remains deeply conflicted. On the one hand, he continues to praise the young man, still in love, still admiring the youth's beauty, still valuing his own role and status as the poet's, as a friend's favorite writer. On the other hand, he obviously feels sufficiently undermined that he sets out, in effect, on a quest to try to discover the real nature of the friend. Can he trust him at all in the light of what's already happened? Or is the friend fundamentally faithful, yet given to unexpected and uncontrolled moments of great weakness that result in periodic acts of infidelity? These and other possibilities reveal themselves in the next group of sonnets. There, the evidence of the youth's habitual waywardness begins to tip the balance, and the poet becomes even more bold in his responses. Other observers have begun to blame the young man, and they compare him to a beautiful flower that has been infected and has taken on what's called the rank smell of weeds. Surprisingly, the poet agrees and says that the youth has become, quote, common, unquote. That is, he is too willing to associate with anyone and to give himself over to others far too easily. This indictment is in no sense a conclusion of the poet's quest, but it goes much further than any previous characterization or critique of the young man. At this point, we find ourselves on the brink of one last act of betrayal by the patron friend. Beginning at sonnet 76, a threatening poetic rival, who is in fact a mere flatterer, wanting to get the attention of the patron, appears on the scene, and the next 10 poems play out a drama in which there's a form of contest to win the favor of the patron. But as it turns out, this is not really a battle between the poets. Instead, it's a test of the young man's capacity to understand whose verse is actually expressive of genuine love and commitment, and whose verse is really more in the vein of flattery. Of course, alas, the youth fails the test. He chooses the rival. Of all the youth's offenses, this is by far the most lacerating. The rival takes the poet's place, another robbery, and another act of usurpation. The poet is essentially deprived of everything that he values most, his role as the favorite writer, and at least temporarily, his close relationship with the young man. He responds with a sonnet of farewell, but one that's obviously intended, if possible, not to actually break the relationship, hoping for an ultimate reunion. But for the moment, the poet moves steadily toward a group of sonnets in which he describes the friend as cold, indifferent, and especially someone whose outward beauty serves only to cover up his sins, quote unquote. He describes the young man as a mansion that is possessed by vices, and sins and vices are words we have not obviously encountered before. They seem to unmask the youth, describing him definitively. They've gone much further, in other words, toward some kind of characterization that by now is obviously very, very negative indeed. They bring to a climax, in fact, the quest to understanding the young man's nature. A major line of development in the sequence has come to a provisional climax. But crucial as this moment is, it doesn't represent the last word about the relationship between the two men. It does lead, however, to a critical separation between them, and estrangement that becomes apparent in the next set of poems, where the poet portrays his absence from the friend as a bleak winter. What freezings have I felt, he says, what dark days seen, what old December's barrenness everywhere. The young man has apparently had similar feelings during this absence, because the following sonnets clearly signify not only that the two men have been apart from one another, but also that they have now been reunited. Mutual recommitment is celebrated by the poet in a series of marvelous lyrics that praise the friend's beauty and his ultimate constancy even, all of which will be preserved forever, it is said yet again in the poet's verse. These poems are markedly different from any previous ones in the sequence, and they could not have come earlier. And that's an important point, because again, we're talking about progress here. Because they're written in a tone that seems weathered, as if they accepted and were able to absorb all the tribulations of the past. The newly established relationship is now measured not in terms of weeks or months, but actually in terms of years. 3 years are exactly mentioned, during which a mutual commitment has somehow been sustained in spite of everything. At one point, the poet apologizes to the young man for not having written for some time sonnets of praise and love to him, and he refers to a past when our love was new and then but in the spring. Now, having recovered his poetic voice, he writes very movingly, and here's a poem that's probably not as famous as some of the others, but an extremely beautiful poem, where he's talking about the fact that the friend is aging, time is passing, 3 years have passed, and at the same time, he wants to reaffirm everything he's reaffirmed before. To me, fair friend, you never can be old, for as you were when first your eye I eyed, such seems your beauty still. 3 winters cold have from the forests shook 3 summers' pride, 3 beauteous springs to yellow autumn turned, in process of the seasons have I seen. 3 April perfumes in their hot June's burn, since first I saw you fresh, which yet are green. But ah, doth beauty like a dial hand steal from his figure, and no face pace perceives. So your sweet hue, which methinks still doth stand, hath motion, and mine eye may be deceived. For fear of which, hear this, thou act age unbred, since you were born was beauty's summer dead. Well, if we look back now for a moment, we can see that there's been a series of betrayals on the part of the young friend, and despite the reunion that I've just described, it should perhaps not be surprising that the poet would soon begin at some point to reveal his own weaknesses and faults. In fact, most of the remaining sonnets are devoted first to an incident in which the poet deserts the friend in search of other loves, although he soon returns repentantly, and second, a prolonged affair with the mistress or dark lady, where sexual desire leads leads to controlled lust, uncontrolled lust, in spite of recognition that this person represents a total moral collapse on the part of the poet. In short, the first main section of the sonnets is devoted to the faults of the young man, and the remainder, except for one brief interlude, to those of the poet. In this way, the sonnets begin to achieve a kind of symmetry, a kind of balance that increases our sense of their overall structure. First, the sins or betrayals of the young man, then, for an almost equal amount, those of the poet himself. If we turn to the poet's betrayal of a friend, we see that it's not only happening suddenly, but that it leaves almost immediately to a return to the young man. In other words, the poet leaves, but almost as in the first incident when the young man betrayed the poet and returned very quickly, now the poet, having betrayed the young man, returns also very quickly and asks to be taken back. He offers a series of excuses for his offense, but these are mostly rationalizations. They eventually lead, however, in the course of 12 sonnets, to a much deeper recognition on the poet's part of the nature of genuine love and commitment. And here's another important development in the sequence. For example, the poet no longer mentions the beauty of the young man at all. Beauty comes to be seen as something transient, although it was, of course, a primary motive in the poet's love during the first 108 sonnets. Throughout the first period, therefore, there's the homage to the young man's image. Now, that's simply never mentioned again. Nor does the poet ever mention again the capacity of poetry to immortalize the youth. He never talks again about eternal lines that can preserve beauty or image. What happens during the span of life itself, rather than what may happen afterward in terms of eternizing verse, what happens during the span of life itself becomes the central subject. Indeed, at this point, in the wake of the serious lapse, the poet begins to conceive of love as something that can and must be sustained during the course of one's existence, in spite of all serious human failings, including infidelity. He comes to realize that time and its vagaries can, as he says in Sonnet 115, creep in twixt vows. Time, in other words, can break even the most important vows and change decrees of kings. Tan sacred beauty, blunt the sharpest intents, divert strong minds to the course of altering things. This recognition that even the strongest vows can be suddenly broken leads the poet in the very next sonnet to assert so powerfully that true love does not alter when an alteration finds, or bend when the remover seems to remove. In other words, whatever the other person does, true love doesn't bend, doesn't remove, but stays steady. The famous lines declaring that love is an ever-fixed mark that looks on tempests and is never shaken define love in a way that we haven't actually encountered before, as a kind of invincible determination. It's an act of willpower to seem absolutely true and constant in the face of all changes, all mutability. As events turn out, the poet, in spite of his later obsession with the mistress, does in fact remain committed to the friend to the very end. A conception of love has emerged that's vastly different from and much deeper than the appealing but untested innocence that long ago had led to the sonnets like "Shall I Compare Thee to a Summer Day?" After the poet's act of unfaithfulness, there's a final reunion between the two men, and this is followed by a small number of sonnets that focus completely on the poet's devotion to constancy and love. He defies time by saying that he himself will never change, and he offers the friends not poetry per se, but something much more pallid. Let me be obsequious in thy heart, he says, and take thou my oblation, poor but free, which is not mixed with seconds, knows no art, but mutual render, only me for thee. These lines bring to a close the poet's sonnets to the young man, and they represent the poet's most profound effort to bring about a genuine marriage of true minds, mutual render, only me for thee. In other words, we hear nothing at all about beauty. We hear nothing about the eternizing capacity of love to preserve beauty, or of verse to preserve beauty. There's only the sense that there ought to be a mutual commitment between the two, only thee for me. The last part of the sequence concerns the poet's effort to win back the favors of the dark lady or mistress. He first declares that everyone believes that she epitomizes beauty herself. He then describes her as the fairest and most precious jewel. Soon, however, he begins to discover her deceitfulness and promiscuousness, but he nevertheless continues to pursue her simply because he cannot control his desires. In several poems, he rebukes himself for his lack of restraint, recognizing that his eyes and passion lead him on, despite all that his better judgment tells him. Indeed, many of these final poems are efforts on the part of the poet to analyze his dilemma without being able to resolve it. This predicament leads to a moment when he essentially unmasks the mistress in a way that parallels the earlier unmasking of the young man. The poet now says of her, "My thoughts and my discourse, as madmen's are, at random from the truth vainly expressed. For I have sworn thee fair and thought thee bright. Thou art as black as hell and dark as night." This revelation does not, of course, lead to a change in either the poet or the mistress' lust, and a form of madness continues to rule the poet to the end. Although there's one final twist, the discovery that the young friend is also enthralled to the mistress. He too cannot resist her, and her complete possession of him represents one more loss, one more theft or robbery that the poet must bear. Let me conclude by tracing the ideas and themes that seem to me to endow the sonnets with an order, a development that has some of the elements of drama and some of narrative. First, the sequence demonstrates a progression from a time when the mutual love between the poet and friend, the potential marriage of true minds, prevails. That's in the early sonnets. This love is then deeply compromised, first by the faults of the young man, and later by those of the poet. Eventually, both give in not merely to intermittent acts of passion and infidelity, but to an irresistible lust in their relationship to the mistress. In short, the sequence reveals a movement from an early period of faithfulness in love through a series of major lapses to a complete loss of all value. The poet and young man both experience a symbolic and an actual fall from the grace of the potential idealistic state that existed in the beginning of the sequence to a final situation in which, at the end, both suffer what the poet calls a kind of hell from which they cannot escape. So that's one major theme of a long fall, as it were, from the very early commitment of both of them to one another, to the complete collapse at the end. The central section of the sequence is devoted, as we've seen, to the poet's quest to understand the nature of his friend, who is alternately faithful or inconstant, and then in the end, I think, largely unfathomable. I've already described in some detail how this quest proceeds. The poet's confronted by a series of infidelities, and he responds more forcefully and boldly to each successive one. The last, when it describes the young man as a mansion of vices, is so fierce that it provokes a lengthy separation between the two, bringing a major line of development in the sequence to a climax. Only a prolonged absence and estrangement is sufficient to revive mutual feelings of affection, leading to the series of love sonnets, different in tone and perspective from any of the earlier ones. There is, as I said, a partial parallel in the sonnets to the mistress when the poet declares that he once considered her fair and bright, as he did the young man, but later black as hell and dark as night, which he did of the young man briefly. A third significant theme concerns the steady loss or dispossession of all that the poet values most. This is a pattern that we find in several of Shakespeare's plays, beginning with Richard II and stretching at least as far as King Lear. In the sonnet, the poet suffers his first great loss in a very early poem, which I haven't had the chance to discuss, when nature herself steals the young man away. Later, unknown others entice the friend away from the poet, and the poet cries out, "He was but 1 hour mine." Next, the friend takes possession of the poet's mistress, and the poet declares, "I do forgive thy robbery, gentle thief, although thou steal me all my poverty." Still later, a rival usurps the poet's place. The poet's deprived not only of his role as chosen or favorite writer, but also of the close relationship he's had with the young man. He writes, "Thus have I had thee, as a dream doth flatter, in sleep a king, but waking no such matter." Although this loss is also temporary, the young friend is ultimately and definitively taken away from the poet, enthralled to the mistress. This occurs near the very end of the sequence, when the poet says about the friend, "Him have I lost. Thou hast both him and me," he says to the mistress. Then the poet summarizes the full extent of all his deprivations, his total dispossession, in another poem to the mistress. He declares, "Me from myself thy cruel eye hath taken, and my next self," meaning the friend, "thou harder hast engrossed. Of him, myself, and thee, I am forsaken." So there's a total deprivation from having had the mistress and the friend at the beginning to having no one, not even, as he says, himself at the end. Finally, as I suggested, the poet's conception of love changes to a significant way during the course of the sonnets. Even as late as sonnet 108, the beauty of the youth and the poet's ability to make that beauty eternal are celebrated. But in the wake of the poet's own unfaithfulness, he recognizes that beauty is transient, that even his own vows can be broken, and that any genuine commitment to another person must be ready to withstand all the vicissitudes of life, including the loss of beauty, and indeed any alterations, any removals, any infidelities. Only a formidable determination, the capacity to commit, continue as an ever-fixed mark that can brave all the elements and that looks on tempests without shaking at all. Only that capacity can sustain a love that can create a marriage of true minds. In other words, the poet in the end thinks not of beauty, thinks not of preserving images, but thinks only of the fact that whatever happens, whether he's unfaithful or whether the friend is unfaithful, nevertheless, one has to persevere in order to arrive at a point where one has demonstrated one's utter fidelity, and there may be a possibility of a marriage of true minds. Thank you. Now, if there's time for questions, I'd be happy to take some.
I've got questions.
Yes.
You speak of the sequence. Are you referring to the sequence in the first published edition or some later sequence that you or other scholars have determined?
The sequence, am I referring in the sequence to the first published edition or some other sequence that may have been put together by scholars or myself? No, definitely in the 1609 published edition. It's really the only responsible, as it were, and authentic thing to go by. So I'm only talking about that. And I take that as the gospel, so to speak. Yes.
I'm curious whether we have, because we share this universal language to a great extent between our present time and that of the 17th century. To what extent do we find confusion when we refer to love now versus love then? In other words, you said in the beginning of your remarks that you thought perhaps, I think you said, that there might not have been any sexual relationship mm-hmm. between this young man and his admiring poet. We also, I took from your comments, that Shakespeare would have been dependent upon this amour for perhaps some financial mm-hmm. Backing and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So. Nowadays, we think of love as being perhaps a bit more black and white between the sexes. Mm-hmm. In other words, we don't, in those days, perhaps women, because they didn't have the advantage of education and many other social advantages which a man might have, even if he were coming up in the world, it would be natural for someone like Shakespeare to find an affinity for a handsome younger man in a sexual way, but we mm-hmm. have to say it, maybe it never came to that. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it seems to me we are sharing this language, but we're not, in this day and age, understanding the language mm-hmm. as well as we might. What does he mean by the young man not being faithful to him?
Yeah, he doesn't actually use that word. Only because it's the only word I can find to suggest the reaction of the poet to the loss of the young man. It's a kind of, sometimes I use the word betrayal, sometimes I use the word infidelity, etc. It's difficult to characterize. The question had in a sense to do with what kind of a love is this anyway, and since we share the same terminology, we don't necessarily mean the same things between the 16th century and the present. It's a mystery. There is simply nothing in the text that suggests that there's a sexual relationship between the two men. And there's nothing that even, I feel, hints at that. So I'm inclined to take it as what we might today call a very powerful attraction, but not one that is really felt to be in any way consummated, and that, as the poet himself says, the mistress and whom he, of course, is obsessed by in the whole latter part of the sequence, the mistress and friends, also possession of the same mistress, is really the sexual content of the sequence. It's been interpreted in totally different ways, though. I mean, there have been books that have tried to show that there's a homosexual relationship. There There have been books that have used the word homoerotic, which is an interesting word, but not one that I'm sure I totally understand. But so I've chosen the one that the poet himself uses in terms of a marriage of true lines.
Yeah, so I mean, you can imagine he no longer spends evening having dinner with me and talking about poetry,
yes,
and so
right,
on, as opposed to having a sexual relationship,
yeah,
which one might not even think of having on the spur of the moment. You might, you know,
right,
in those days want to plan something while ahead,
yes,
for many reasons.
Well, in fact, in a couple of poems, he talks about having walks and talks. He doesn't use precisely that phrase, but with the young man, being companions and so on. But he doesn't go any further than that. Yes?
Do you have any sense or idea who these two people were?
Do I have any sense of who these people actually were?
Yeah.
No. again, first of all, it's a fundamental question. Is Shakespeare writing these poems about himself, out of his own experience? Or, since he was capable of creating dozens and dozens and dozens of characters of totally different types in his plays, perhaps this is a fictional concoction. Or perhaps there's some piece of experience there that he's elaborated upon in order to make, as it were, a fiction out of it, but nonetheless based on some part that he experienced. But the answer is, alas, there is, as I said before, no external evidence of any kind whatsoever that can point us to any of the people. And people have tried tremendously hard to find out who the dark lady is, and there have been theories about it, but none of them seem to be, since there's no evidence, none of them seem to me to be very persuasive. Even if you were somehow to find out that the dark lady's name was really, Marilyn Monroe, or just to choose a random name, unless you knew more than that, it's not obvious how that would help you. You really want to know, if anything, what the experience was. And that's all we have to go on there are the poems themselves. So, as I said, no objective evidence whatsoever. One reason why they're such mysterious poems in a way. Yes?
For some of us, I think, at least in my case, I feel really much closer to the plays than to the sonnets.
Yeah.
And but are there particular plays that, in a sense, you feel are somewhat on the same wavelength,
mm-hmm,
of the sonnets?
Mm-hmm.
And could you talk about them?
Mm-hmm. Are there particular plays that are on the same wavelength, so to speak, of the sonnets? And obviously, in some sense, we all know the plays much better. Reading 154 sonnets is not an easy job. And reading them more than once in order to try to make a particular kind of sense out of them is an even harder job. So it's not surprising that we know only the ones that are the most famous. I think it would be hard to find more than slight comparison. Some of the plays. I mean, in a couple of the early comedies, for instance, there are situations that partly resemble the triangular nature of the of what we see in the sonnets. In some of the later comedies, there are, of course, these role reversals where, as in Twelfth Night, where the woman dresses up as a young man, and the prince or duke, in effect, almost falls in love with her, him. But it all becomes a comic ending once she's undisguised. But there is play in Shakespeare between different efforts to use particularly women dressed as men in order to complicate common plots, especially in 12th Night. Again, that always comes out the right way, as it were. The young man is revealed to be a woman with whom the Duke falls in love immediately. So, again, there are little hints and traces. There's nothing that comes close to the sonnets, I think, really. Yes. What is it in the sonnets that makes me believe that there's a patron relationship there rather than someone who simply admires the poetry, let's say? I think it's a very special kind of patron relationship. Most patron relationships in Elizabethan time were rather distant in the sense that you dedicated, as Shakespeare did in fact, to a royal or an aristocratic person, two poems, hoping to get recompensed for the dedication. But that was a relationship that was quite distant, as most patron poet relationships were. I think here, the patronage piece seems so strong, particularly when you have the rival poet series, because it's obvious that the rival poet is vying for the attention and the capacity to be favored by the young man and to displace the poet. That's, for me at least, the strongest sense of there being a patronage relationship. But it doesn't seem at all to me to be like the normal one. And I don't get the impression anywhere in the sonnets that there's money involved, as it were, that you write me some great poems and I'll give you every once in a while a bit of a tip, as it were. So it's a very unusual relationship. But I think the rival poet series does push hard on the idea of patronage, and it makes it difficult to understand what's going on unless there's an effort to try to lure this person away.
Well, I think, are there questions? So thank you so much for...